Hi, listeners. Welcome to Life of a Teen, a podcast that dives into the thoughts of teenagers on pressing topics such as broad as leadership or as deep as mental health. Join Aaron, Quincy, V, Catherine, and Olivia in their exploration of their thoughts, experiences, and solutions. Today's topic may include discussion of intense subject matter such as suicide, substance misuse, and mental illness. This may be upsetting to some listeners. Please be advised and seek resources when needed. So today, we are here with DEA agent John Delena to talk about substance misuse in New Hampshire. So just a bit of an introduction on John. So what is your role and how long have you been in this type of work?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here with you guys. So I've actually been in law enforcement for almost 30 years now, and I've been with the DEA for 25 years.
Very cool.
I currently hold the position of the Associate Special Agent in Charge for DEA's New England Field Division. So I actually oversee all of DEA operations in the six New England states.
Wow. All right. And what do you love about your work? What do you do in that job that you really like?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a couple different things about it. The first is the work itself. I really believe in it. I am a kid that grew up surrounded by drug misuse, and I saw it throughout, my entire childhood, and I sort of had a chip on my shoulder from a young age because of it. So I wanted to be part of pushing that back and part of the solution. I also like the way that DEA works. We sort of set up in groups and teams. It's almost like an athletic team. You rely upon one another. There may be 10 people in your group, and you may be helping out one person one day, and the other nine folks may be helping you out the next. So I sort of like that style of work.
That's very cool. What are some of the most important lessons that you've learned as a DEA agent?
Well, the drug crisis has really had a tremendous impact on the country, but also particularly here in New Hampshire and around the areas that I grew up in. And while for maybe 25 years of my law enforcement career, it was simply about chasing bad guys and making cases and really just, moving on to the next target once I completed one case. Over the last 5 years, I've connected more with the community than ever before, and particularly the young people. And I've tried to, really elevate all of the work that they're doing and try to find ways to make that seamless sort of connection between the work that DEA does and the work that the young people in our communities can do. And we've had a lot of success here in New Hampshire doing that.
Perfect segue into our next topic, which is going to be, why is it important to involve youth in your work? And that's actually one of the main reasons we wanted you here, was to be the bridge between the teenagers and the adults who are working on these cases, especially in New Hampshire. So would you mind elaborating a little bit on why it's so important?
I think for the longest time, people just assumed that young people wanted to be told, don't do this and don't do that. And nobody really spent a lot of time trying to explain to them why and what was going on. And when I came back to this area after being away for most of my entire career and most of my adult life, quite frankly, I came at a time when the opioid crisis was at its all-time high, and New Hampshire especially was feeling the effects of it. And I could see the damage that had been really ravaged throughout all of our communities, and I could see how kids were being impacted by this. So I tried to find a way to bring everything together. In 2017, we hosted the nation's first ever Youth Opioid Summit, and it was a time that we thought we could stand up in front of young people and explain to them the seriousness of the problem, but also do it in an empowering way and ask them to be part of it. And, when I stood up there in front of what was then about 8,500 kids at the SNHU arena, I remember asking those young people to be upstanders and not bystanders, to actually stand up and join me in this fight. And I challenged everybody in the crowd to do that. Some of those kids are here with me today during this podcast. And that, that in itself has had tremendous impact on me. And I think that, it's hard for maybe for you guys to understand this, but DEA is a worldwide organization. Okay. We have more people overseas in foreign countries than any other federal law enforcement agency. We have more people around the country than you could possibly imagine. What we've done here in New Hampshire since 2017 has really set the groundwork for the rest of the country. DEA has completely revamped how they look at prevention and how they connect with young people because of what we, and I mean the collective we, and we're sitting here in the offices of Making It Happen, which has really been the best partner of all throughout all this, but DEA has completely revamped the way they look at prevention because of what we were able to accomplish here. And, you know, I know that from personal involvement, from actual DEA offices calling me saying, how did you do that? And how can we do the same thing? And they took even the event that we did, the Youth Summit, with the Wahlberg Foundation, and that's become sort of a DEA standard event now that we're trying to do in all parts of the country. So we've taken a lot from it. We've learned just as much from the young people I know I have as hopefully you've learned from us, and we've really been able to maximize the partnership.
Absolutely. That's so amazing. And I think Aaron, my partner, and I should both maybe talk a little bit about the first three-day training with CADCA that occurred immediately after that youth summit. That was direct engagement with the youth, and that's when DA 360, we were introduced to you guys and really got the ball rolling, which was the turn of the tide, which is the exact words that were told to us students in New Hampshire. So Aaron, would you like to kick off a little bit?
Yeah, so back when I was in, eighth grade, and now I'm a senior, back in eighth grade, I was invited to a training from one of my counselors, and I didn't know what I was doing. I was like, oh yeah, sure, I'll attend. They just told me I was like a good guy in that, like, you know, why not get involved with like other good people? So I was like, sure.
Yep.
And what ended up happening is that I was put in a group with maybe five other people from my high school, and we were taught techniques on how to combat drug issues or just problems in our community.
That's right.
And so those couple days transformed me and how I thought that teen can have an impact. Mm-hmm. Because we're always told, have a voice, speak up, but no one ever teaches you how.
Right. And I think it was so important to have the adults there who are encouraging and listening and writing down our thoughts and ideas, and having DEA back us up and partner us with WMUR so that way we could be on the town hall and talk to Governor Sununu. It was such an eye-opening experience, but also not only were we heard and feeling empowered ourselves, but I really feel that that empowered other youth too to see their peers, their friends who are really standing up.
So why don't we wait for a second and maybe go backwards, and I'll fill you in a little bit about what was going on behind the scenes
and
how that event came together. So we're talking about what was known as then DEA 360, and it came to this area, and you know, it had a few different selected events with it. And of course, much like I've done most of my life and my career, I took everything that they gave me and I threw it in the garbage. And I decided to find a way to work what was best here. And a lot of that has to do with Mary Forsyth Tabor, who's the executive director of the Making It Happen Coalition for Resilient Youth. I got to meet Mary. I had no prior dealings with her. And I told her that this thing was coming. And you know, she was like, you know, John, we're doing a lot of that already. You know, but really what this area needs more than ever is prevention, you know, to be elevated and to find a way to connect to young people. When the opioid crisis was at its worst here, people were trying to figure out ways to deal with enforcement and to deal with treatment, but prevention was sort of getting pushed to the back of the room. So I really listened to what Mary was saying to me, and I tried to find a way to do that. Of course, that turned into, because of this relationship with the Mark Wahlberg Youth Foundation, getting the Wahlbergs to sort of join me and put on that event. But after the event, I had this vision that we could get these kids trained and perhaps do this, what I was calling a reverse town hall. We had seen enough town halls, and quite frankly, I was part of all those events and all these big meetings with then-Governor Hassan and every community group, and it was the same adults talking about the same stuff every time. Then we would leave, and then I'd go to the next one, and we'd talk about the same stuff all over again. And I felt like it was time to actually to make a difference. So I thought about a reverse town hall, that instead of us telling everyone what they should know, maybe we could actually listen to the kids And then it was CATCA who came in and said, why don't we provide some leadership training under this DEA 360 umbrella and teach these kids a little bit. And the plan then was to not tell you kids who were at the training what we were going to ask you in the end, which was to join us for the town hall, because I didn't want to freak anybody out. And I also didn't want to, you know, sometimes when you know something like that's going to happen, you start acting differently. So I wanted all the kids to sort of just be themselves. And we had kids from all different schools come together. And it was kind of cool watching from, you know, being an adult in the back of the room, watching these young kids originally sticking with the kids from their own school. And then by the second day, sort of everybody merging together and becoming one. And I saw a lot of progress. And it was the last day of the training. It was the last hour of the training where we said, hey, if you're interested in doing something else, which the training was ending on a Sunday and the TV show was going to be filmed on Tuesday. So I asked if you were interested, hang out an extra day. I think 13 kids decided to stay. And that's when we let you know that we were going to do this TV show. Of course, everybody got a little bit freaked out, but we said everything will be fine. And really what we said was, on your own, think about what you want to tell us. So none of it was scripted. None of it was put in front of the young people. And the only thing we asked was that they come on Monday to what was going to be the TV studio at St. Anselm's College, where they film major presidential debates. And, you know, it was this giant room built to be a TV studio. And we were going to have 100 community leaders fill a live audience to film that day. And the rest, as Quincy, as you were saying, really, you know, turned into what I think was something that, you know, has turned everything in a different direction, because we heard things from young people that day that nobody had actually heard. In fact, V, what I'll tell you is, one of the things that already came up as we were talking before we went on to this podcast was that young people don't use some of the social media platforms that grownups do, mm-hmm. right? And we were talking about maybe putting PSAs out for things like drug take back. But, you know, a lot of times adults just have this narrow focus thinking, okay, we're going to put a PSA up on TV. But we learned that day as we were filming this TV broadcast that from the words of one of the students, we don't watch TV. You know, we watch Netflix, we watch Hulu, and we don't see all the PSAs that we're spending all this money to get on TV. So that's why we need to find other ways to connect with young people. And we've learned a lot from that. And, you know, I'm proud to say that in 2017, I met a lot of great young people. And here we are in 2021, and some of them are still actively involved. I've written some recommendations for college for others. Some are already at college. And I look forward to seeing, you know, the great work that everybody can do.
That's amazing.
I think it really worked. That training did 100%. Make me become the person I am today.
Like, I would agree.
That Community Anti-Drug Coalition for America, CADCA, it transformed us, that group.
Absolutely, because it helped us get the foundation of how to identify a problem in your community, find the risk factors, and figure out what exactly is needed to be done, what would really target the youth, what would change their perspectives on what they think is cool or what they want to do or whatever. But instead, we showed that it wasn't cool and how to help our own friends. I think that was the most important part, was like, you can really convince your peers to do the right thing and live a healthy lifestyle with the tools that CADCA provided, and with the being backed up by DA 360 and doing the town hall, because not only were they watching that and like, oh, like, that's really cool, look at these people who are watching, these people who are like our friends who are on TV, but also, I don't even think that was the most important part, but just the part that it was the first big initiation for young people to truly get involved, and it was just the first thing of many to come.
And I think one of the best parts about that for me was, if I weren't to have that training, I probably would have done some poor decisions in my high school life. Mm-hmm. And without that training, I wouldn't have been able to say, no, I don't want to do that.
Right.
But it was supportive. And mm-hmm. with the backup of the adults and feeling like other teens were with me, it made me feel good that I was able to say, no, I don't want to do that.
Absolutely. And being able to meet people from every single school, it was really cool because you made new connections. And so it wasn't like you were just helping the people at your school, your friends. It was that overall, you were helping people all across the 603 area. So that was very cool too.
That's something I wanted to add on to. And I know me and Olivia haven't been to as many like trainings as Quincy and Aaron have. But I know that first training, it was in Winneconnet, I think. And it was a NAMI suicide prevention meeting, training. And it was like you and Aaron were saying, you kind of felt that like community sense. And it was really empowering to see so many like kids in one area who are all there for like that same sort of goal. And here, like 3 years later, I know all of us are part of the Governor's Youth Advisory Council doing work right under the governor for the state of New Hampshire. So I would want to say to like anyone listening in our audience who is part of like the youth, if you have an opportunity to go to one of these trainings by your school, just ask also. Yes. Like our schools are looking for people who are interested in Absolutely. This kind of thing. And John, maybe you can touch upon this, but a big reason that I decided to kind of like continue with this type of work is because I really do think that prevention is really important. And I think it starts at the youth level, which is like a really big reason why I think that especially in substance abuse, youth are like the most important demographic, even though you might see more older people.
But it starts young.
It starts young, exactly.
Who can convince the younger people to like, oh, try this, take this, because then it's all about the buyers and dealers, right? Can they get more people to make more money? And the young people are way more naive, and they're the people who are often get addicted young, and then they're consistent buyers, and that's a big issue.
Yeah, and V, you know, you brought up a couple of good points. I always say that prevention, first of all, it's a longer-term solution to a problem that everybody wants us to solve tomorrow. But that doesn't mean we give up on it, right? And I liken it to sort of sowing these seeds, and you're planting these seeds at the youngest possible age to the youngest possible people in hopes that 3, 4, 5 years from now, when they are faced with that very tough decision, that they have some background there and they feel like they can make a healthy, empowered decision to say no or to avoid a problem. You know, and we've had the most success here by recruiting at the youngest possible ages and watching, you know, that the middle schoolers morph into high schoolers, but then rely upon you as high schoolers to help us find the next wave of young people so that this doesn't just end with you guys and girls. I mean, we want it to continue. So we need younger people from our local schools to get involved with it and to feel comfortable. And like you said, V, you know, this is something that I think as Aaron and Quincy can attest to, because they were part of some of those trainings, maybe they went into it thinking, you know, who am I going to see there? How am I going to interact with people? But what you end up seeing is kids that look just like you, you know, from, you know, maybe a different part of the country, but they're dealing with the same stuff. And when you're around that, you know, similar people, like-minded people, and you realize, you know, you can talk comfortably about the things that worry you, concern you, or maybe you're challenging at home or in school, you know, and you have that support system built in, it seemed to work. And that's why we need to continue to grow this out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's another thing, too, that you were mentioning, meeting people from different states and things like that. The CADCA mid-year, the first one that we did, meeting how many students was it? Like 600 or close to that.
Too many.
Yeah. No, but that was amazing because we were able to hear from other communities and what's going on there and taking what they've already done and bringing it back to our own community and vice versa. Yeah. So that way we were helping people nationwide.
And it was a big step. We got some donations, and you guys were able to travel to Atlanta to attend that training, and Mary and some of the other volunteers that went along with it, you know, really stepped up and wanted to expose you to something. And I think, you know, again, all of those were steps that led to, you know, sitting around this table here today. And even the folks that came in a little bit later, you know, in terms of the whole program, you've made such an impact. You know, you're out there at the events that we have now, like Drug Take Back and some of these other things. It's so important to have you part of this. And hopefully you'll continue it wherever you go, wherever this, you know, path may take you. But also, you know, when you're leaning back into your communities, you know, you're talking to younger people and find ways to get them involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Not to like move us too far along, but I'm just thinking that
quickly. I want to get Olivia's thoughts
on
this.
Do you mind if I actually have a question I was going to ask, and it's specifically about how you were mentioning your upbringing and how you were kind of raised in this community where drug use was prevalent, and I think I can also relate to that. But how were you able to shape yourself to make sure that you weren't that bystander, that you were that upstander, so now that you can inspire others to do that?
That's a great question, and I appreciate you sharing that. And the truth is that I didn't have an outlet like this. So a lot of it was internalized, and a lot of it was me on my own, screaming in my own head, trying to figure out just what was going on around me. I look back now, and I say, man, I wish I had something like this. I could have benefited so much from it all. You know, I kept most of it quiet. I kept it quiet. I didn't talk to anybody about it. There was nobody I felt like I could open up to. And that's why when I look at some of the kids that are involved with this program now, I think of really how blessed they are, because there is an outlet there. You know, I look at the schools and the SAP program that we have, you know, where you can have this comfortable relationship with somebody if you needed outreach. So I didn't have it. I got lucky. I got lucky that I think that, you know, there was a lot of times in my life that I was sort of, you know, at a fork in the road, and I could have very easily gone in a different direction. What I ended up doing was packing up my car and getting out of my neighborhood and out of my state, and I went away to college by myself. And, you know, I sort of, you know, reinvented who I was, and a lot of this is now just looking back and reflecting back on, you know, some of those difficult things that were put in front of me at a young age.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Do you find it kind of ironic that you feel that you were put in a lot of difficult situations and yet you were the head of the DEA for the Northeast?
Yeah, there's definitely some irony there. But, you know, I've worked hard. I've been really focused, you know, since I started this career. And, you know, a lot of it is luck. I've had some good breaks, but I continue to stay energized. You know, it goes back to one of the first questions you guys asked me, you know, about what I love, what I do. Mm-hmm. I love what I do. I love being here today. I love thinking about the progress that we've made. But, you know, I have a million things I want to accomplish before I retire.
That's amazing. So do you feel like getting on your feet and getting started was more challenging? Or do you feel like pushing us to the point that we are at now was more challenging? Or, like, how do you perceive that?
You know, I think there's just a lot of challenges, Quincy. I think, you know, there is, you know, this drug crisis is very fluid. We're faced with a lot of challenges that the bad guys and the criminal organizations and the cartels put together. You know, I think that they don't care how many people die of a drug overdose in this country. And I think the CDC said that last year we had the most overdoses ever. Around 83,000 Americans died of a drug overdose. Wow. 83,000 Americans.
Crazy.
But that's never going to stop the drug cartels from changing what they do. And, you know, they'll always be adding new drugs and finding ways to get them into this country to continue to addict people, because they're driven by one thing, and that's greed.
That's right. They're making
billions and billions of dollars off of the addiction of the people in our country, and we have to all work together to stop that.
And Absolutely. Then kind of adding on to that, would you find a large challenge being time, like how much time we all have to address these issues?
Yeah, that's, I'll tell you, it's funny. You know, I had this conversation with the men and women that worked directly for me that, you know, this past week. We're talking about there's so many things that we want to accomplish, and there's so many things that we need to do in terms of, say, training and outreach. There's just so much time in the day, though. So a lot of that is being able to properly manage your day. But in my line of work, the difficult part is that no matter how well you plan, things seem to always come up. Like, you know, when we're dealing with a criminal organization, they don't work 9 to 5. They don't work banker's hours.
Right. And it's a revolving door.
It is. And, you know, you can't really always rely on them, even at the highest level. You know, you may have a meeting set for 2 o'clock in the afternoon and they just don't show up. And then you wait, and next thing you know, it's 10:30 at night and you're running out there. And that could be Christmas Day, that could be your kid's birthday, the most important Little League game that your kid has. But that's the job that we signed up to do. And that's what the brave men and women that work for me and work in the DEA do every single day.
I'm really happy that that's not a deterrent, because I know for many people, when they see a challenge that big or continuing to get set back, they say, let's not even deal with it. So I'm really glad that you continue to push and continue to fight for what you know is right and staying true to yourself.
Absolutely. And I think the same thing with you, with your schoolwork and your outside, you know, commitments, and maybe if you have a job or your family commitments, you have to be able to find some balance there. And that's very important as well. But it can never be a deterrent. You can't just walk away from it because it's getting difficult.
Piggybacking on what you said about the cartels finding new ways to get drugs into the country and everything like that, I want to ask you about the current and newer methamphetamine crisis in New Hampshire and what's so concerning about it.
Well, it is absolutely my biggest concern right now. I don't think anything's upset me or concerned me more in my career than the most recent challenge, which is that the cartels are manufacturing Adderall pills and making them with nothing but crystal methamphetamine. So they look exactly like an Adderall. Mm-hmm. And you can be the most seasoned DEA investigator that we have, and if you're looking at them, you won't be able to tell the difference. It isn't until we test them or get them to a lab that we can find out that they're actually made with nothing but methamphetamine. In my opinion, as a 30-year law enforcement veteran, as somebody that's in charge of the DEA in this area, that means that the cartels have made a business decision to target young people. They know. None of the decisions that they make happen by accident. They sit around a boardroom just like a Fortune 500 company does, and they make decisions. That's how big, you're talking about a $1 billion company when you're talking about somebody like the Sinaloa cartel. They know that they have a lot of children in America who use and abuse Adderall. They know that in middle, high school, and college, kids are moving and passing pills around. There's a lot of kids that have these pills prescribed to them, and that's okay. But they also know that a lot of people are sharing pills. They know that there's a misconception out there that Adderall makes you smarter, or it makes you faster, a better pitcher or a better quarterback, and that's just not the case. But that's why kids are abusing these pills, and they are now mass producing them, millions of them, and flooding the country with them, and they're all around us right now in this area. They're everywhere, and that's very concerning to me.
Absolutely, and this is something that I just want to confirm, because I know that there are some people who are a little bit ignorant to how this stuff really goes around. This is stuff that's specifically being sold on the streets, not through CVS Pharmacy or Rite Aid or whatever like that.
Yeah.
Because that's all regulated. It's the stuff on the streets that we're mainly concerned about.
So I'm glad you pointed that out, and that's a good clarification. So if you have Adderall that a doctor prescribed to you, that you went to the pharmacy and filled, and it's been in your possession the whole time, then you're okay.
Right.
And that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about illicitly manufactured Adderall pills made with methamphetamine. And those are the ones that are sort of getting mixed up into the stream, you know, that are out there. So if you're buying pills off of the street, off of somebody, or somebody's handing you pills, I can tell you right now that there's a very, very high likelihood that those pills are going to be the ones that are made with methamphetamine, because there aren't a lot of pills that are being illegally diverted from a pharmacy. So Nobody robbed a pharmacy of 55,000 pills and they're out there on the street right now. However, 10 years ago, that's what was happening with opioids. There was a lot of people being overprescribed, so there were a lot of legitimate pills into the stream. There was also a lot of pharmacy robberies. That was a major thing that we were dealing with. There was trucks and pharmacies being robbed, so hundreds of thousands of pills that were legitimate pills ended up on the street, as you said. But these are pills that are specifically being manufactured by the cartel and brought into the country right now.
Thank you for that clarification.
Would you be able to talk about some of the effects of methamphetamine by any chance for our listeners?
Yep. So we're talking really, particularly here in New Hampshire over the last year, about this increase in crystal methamphetamine. And there's always been meth that has been produced in local small labs. We call them labs, where somebody can actually take a lot of ingredients that you can get over the counter, and most of them are disgusting. And if you know how to do it, and you can put it together in a 2-liter bottle, it can produce small amounts of low purity methamphetamine. This is different what we're talking about. Now we're talking about crystal methamphetamine being made in a lab in Mexico and sent up here. The difference is they can send it up by the pound and by the kilo, so a lot more, and also the purity is through the roof. What they're able to manufacture in these labs, I can tell you that from the testing that we've done just this week alone on the stuff that we've seized, is around 99 to 100% pure.
Wow.
Which is absolutely incredible, but it's so, so strong and so, so potent. The other thing is it has a completely different effect on the user than the opioids and the fentanyl that we've been so used to here, especially in New Hampshire. It's the exact opposite. So the opioids and the fentanyl will sort of bring you down into a low. And now you have these drug traffickers saying, by the way, if you're down and you're low and you need help sort of getting up and getting motivated, try a little bit of this meth and that'll bring you back up. The result is very, very toxic in your body. Mm-hmm. First of all, there's severe increased levels of violence associated with somebody that's using methamphetamine. So we're seeing a lot more fights, law enforcement, first responders who are now at risk because users, there's a proclivity towards weapons. They like to have guns. And that has led to a lot of problems just locally here in our area alone. We also have seen through the medical examiner who sadly has to look at the toxicology of people that overdose and die, there's now more combination of meth and fentanyl than ever before. So we know it's here, we know it's out there, and we know there's a lot of challenges associated with it. It has ravaging effects on the body. If you look at any of the videos, and if you go online and look at, say, the faces of meth, what you see is it ends up wearing people away. They end up looking 10 years, 15, 20 years older over the course of a year. They lose their teeth. It rots people's teeth out of their head. And it's so awful, the effects it has on people. But again, this wasn't done by accident. This was a cartel-driven decision. Who wants this to be in our area? They want it in New Hampshire. They want to addict more people.
So can I ask you a quick question? For those who are trying to get that high to be focused for school, if they make a bad decision like that, and they do get their hands on the wrong type of Adderall, the type that is meth, then how would it affect a first-time user accidentally if they took too much?
You know, one thing you have to keep in mind is that when a cartel or a drug trafficker is making something up and now trying to fit it into a pill, they have no oversight. This isn't a legitimate pharmaceutical company.
Right.
So they don't even know how much of the active ingredient ends up in each of those pills, nor do they care.
Wow.
They don't care. And really, that's why we've seen, when you're talking about fentanyl now, we see so much overdoses because they don't have a proper way to dose it. So you might get more than the person next to you, and using may result in an overdose death for you. And the same thing goes for the methamphetamine. So there's no real way for them to manage how much is in each pill. That's number one. Number two is some people get a pill and it's time released and they're not used to having to wait to feel some effects. So we've already heard cases locally where people have said, oh, this must not be working, so I'll take three more. That's
wow.
A problem.
Yeah.
And lastly, it's going to have a much different effect on you if you think you're taking or maybe have been taking Adderall.
Right.
Than if you're all of a sudden taking a certain dose of crystal methamphetamine.
You're going to freak out.
Yeah, it would be a different effect.
That's what we're afraid of.
Right, absolutely.
I do have a question of more of you find out someone you know is using Adderall and you know they're buying it off the street. Like, what now? You see these effects. What should you do? Like, talking specifically to youth.
You know, I wouldn't have invested so much time over the last 2 weeks getting out onto the news and out into the communities to spread this word if I didn't think it was alarmingly important that anybody who may be around this stuff needs to know. So if you are somebody that does know somebody that's buying pills like this off the street, first of all, you have to maybe say, hey, did you hear that right now they're saying pretty much everything is being made with methamphetamine and you know there's a serious, serious problem. You have to have a conversation with that person and with somebody. you know, I think right now too many lives are at risk to just ignore it. You can't do that. There's just so much at stake right now. These pills are so, so dangerous, and we're seizing them by the thousands every day right now in New Hampshire. It's got me really, really concerned.
Wow. Something I want to touch upon a little, not off topic, but when you say these things aren't made at like labs or anything like that, I want to talk about like marijuana that a lot of teens will get on the street and stuff like that, and the type of things that those can be cut with that people can get addicted on, because this methamphetamine problem crisis actually is a huge problem in the youth. But I think from right now, what we see, at least me in Bedford, is that the most drug that is used is marijuana. There's no way to get legal marijuana in New Hampshire.
I would agree. Yeah, I would agree with that. That and nicotine products like
right,
Poland,
correct.
Vaping.
So what would you like say to that?
Well, you know, I'll tell you that having done this for as long as I have, I've seen it all. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, it's not uncommon for a dealer to want to try to make their products separate from any other dealer's products. We have seen people who have tried to lace marijuana with fentanyl, with methamphetamine, with PCP, with anything you could possibly imagine. You know, and I just say buyer beware.
Mm-hmm.
We also know, and you guys have done a good job talking about this in the past, but you know, the THC levels are at such an increased amount than maybe what your parents or your parents' parents were used to. The marijuana is much different. It's much more potent, and the effects, you know, especially if not dosed properly, like we have people that are putting them into edibles and different variants to, you know, to try to consume them. And again, if that's not done by a professional, you don't know how much you're getting and how strong that dose is, it could have major effects on the user.
Absolutely. And I think this goes back to something that I did a few years ago, was testifying against the bill that was trying to pass marijuana to be commercialized in New Hampshire. I still believe that we should keep pushing for it to not be legalized. But how do you feel the state is going as of right now?
You know, I'm really proud of what New Hampshire's accomplished. I think that we have tremendous support, particularly right now from Governor Sununu.
Yes.
You know, he has been very active most recently in the methamphetamine issue. Like we go back to, I think it was January 3rd of this year that he asked the Commissioner of Public Safety and myself to give a briefing to him so he could really understand what these challenges are. And I think, you know, across New Hampshire, we have so many strong community leaders. They want to know what's going on. They want us, you know, to be able to come and brief them, whether it's Making It Happen Coalition, Raymond Coalition for Youth, or any of the other strong coalitions that we have. They want to always stay ahead of the curve, and, you know, they don't want to have to wait to react. And I think we've seen that, especially with the information that we put out on methamphetamine.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we just want to conclude a little bit. And what is the one thing that you want parents and adults to know in general? And what is your advice for anyone, youth or someone else, who would want to get involved in something like this?
All right. Two good questions. For parents, you know, and the message is, you know, we need to be able to have a conversation. It is nothing that you can't talk about at this point. We need to be able to have that conversation. That starts at home. I can tell you that as a parent of three, that it's challenging to have conversations with your kids. It's easier for me to come talk to you guys a little bit sometimes than it is to have conversations with my own kids. But that can't stop you. You have to be able to have a conversation. You have to be able to communicate what we're seeing and you know, what these kids need to be aware of, and be proud of the work that they're doing, you know what I mean? And encourage them to get involved with something like this and prevention, which I think right now, all the schools especially, we need to probably do more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, if parents and kids come together and we sort of push that message toward the schools, maybe we can carve out some more time in the schools.
Well, again, John, Delana, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and we hope to talk to you also in the future.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. We hope you enjoyed and will tune in next week where we discuss Drug Takeback Day happening on April 24th, again with John Delena, coming from Making It Happen in Manchester. Have a great day, everyone.